This is DuPont Manual's Creative Writing Podcast, The Icebox. I'm Sam Baker, joined by Manual students and my fellow editors, Vaishnavi Sankara and Mayuka Bhamadapati. Twice a month, we discuss published works and student pieces in their frozen forms, disagree a little, and thaw them out into possibilities listeners can take away with them. Now, take a moment to get comfortable and tune in to hear Mayuka Bhamadapati reading Soil Horizon by this week's published poet, Tiana Clark.
Soil Horizon. The ghost of history lies down beside me, rolls over, pins me beneath a heavy arm. Natasha Trethewey. My husband's mother wanted to take the family portrait at Carnton Plantation. I was the only person she called to ask if it was okay. She said, we could redeem the land with our picture. My brown skin acrostic to the row of their white. She said, can't we just let the past be the past? I was silent, my cell phone glowing warm against my cheek. I was driving, red light, then go. She said, it's practically in my backyard, and that her boys played on buckled fields of green graves growing up. There's so many fun places to shoot. Oh, and that big magnolia is in bloom. Fragrant milky petals and waxy greens by the red brick house, and the large front porch with rocking chairs tipping back and forth above the purpled stains of Confederate blood. I said it was fine as long as we weren't by the slave cabins, and she laughed, and I laughed, which is to say I wasn't joking at all. She kept saying, redeem, as if to say, we'll make it acceptable, restore and atone, buy it back, pay it off, we'll redeem it, she said again, her voice swelling like she was singing, and as if we really could. How do we stand on the dead and smile? I carry so many black souls in my skin, sometimes I swear it vibrates like a tuning fork when struck. A staff officer wrote, the wounded in hundreds were brought to the house during the battle and all the night after. And when the noble old house could hold no more, the yard was appropriated until the wounded and dead filled that. The plantation was named after Cairns, prophetic stones marking a mass grave still speaking, how the body leaves its mark on wood, plum dark and greasy from the shot, stippled and amputated. My tongue was cut off when she asked me again, are you sure it's okay? I was waiting at the red light. My cell phone burned from the hot battery in my hand. Even the dark layers of dirt must testify, how the Battle of Franklin turned the farmstead to a field hospital. Thousands of casualties during the war for states' rights, the brochure said. And now it's sold out for summer weddings with mint juleps and sweating silver cups, cannon bursts from weekend reenactments, and photo shoots for graduation, pregnant couples, and my new family. It's raining. The photographer is snapping and directing us towards the daffodils, the shutter opening and closing like a tiny guillotine, clicking. I'm staring at the black eye, clutching my smile. Light drizzle turning my pressed hair slowly back to curls, the water percolating, weathering its way down to the bright green topsoil, fertile with the past, organic and holy, wet as Dixie myth, mixing with iron, clay, aluminum, and revision, romancing the dirt and undead, churning the silt in the subsoil, steeping further down, deep, deep, into the dark pocket of earth, to the parent material, layers of large unbroken rocks down to the antebellum base, the bedrock of southern amnesia. Can't we just let the past be the past, she said, her voice swelling like she was singing, and as if we really could. In the portrait, my husband is holding my hand, his hand that dug for bullets as a boy. And that was Soil Horizon by Tiana Clark.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Icebox. I'm Mayuka, I'm a senior in the MSD Magnet at DuPont Manual High School, and I'm joined by two other seniors. V and Sam, do you guys want to introduce yourselves?
Hi guys, I'm Vaishnavi, I go by V, and I'm also a senior at Manual in the MSD Magnet.
Hey everyone, I'm Sam Baker. I'm in the Journalism and Communications Magnet at Manual. I'm really excited we got a chance to do this. Everyone's looking great on a Zoom camera, so we really nailed that part of it, and we'll see how this thing goes.
So, jumping right into it, in the third stanza, when it says, "I was driving, red light, then go," I sort of view that as a turning point in Tiana's thinking, where she hears what her mother-in-law says, and she's kind of surprised by it. And that also, you know, relates to literally what she's doing, right? So she's driving and she has to take a step back from what she just heard, which was something that was reprehensible from her mother-in-law, who is, you know, a close relative.
The amount of possibilities throughout this piece is unbelievable. I think one thing you can see is the dark humor throughout this piece. You can see that in the line, "There are so many fun places to shoot." Kind of like the traffic light, where you just have to sit back for a second and say, okay, what does Clark really mean? The word "shoot" there could be, you know, making fun of something that her mother-in-law said, the ignorance, the level of ignorance embedded in the fact that, you know, "shoot" could refer to the violence associated with the Civil War, the history of slavery. And "shoot" also refers to the photo shoot. Now, had this line said a photo shoot, that would have had an entirely different meaning to the reader. But I think that there is this unexpected but riveting sarcasm throughout this piece. You see it again in one of the final stanzas on the last page. You can see the photographer is snapping. It doesn't say snapping photos. There are these really rigid and quick punches of violence throughout this piece. And I wanted to hear also what you all had to say about that as well, if you have anything on that.
I absolutely agree. So when I first read that, I did not think anything much of it. I mean, I just thought she was talking about the photo shoot session, right? But then to use the word "shoot" itself instead of, you know, photo shoot, like Sam, you were saying, is definitely hitting. And I think I was a little confused as to if that's even what her mother-in-law said, just because it's so, it's just so perfectly poetic where it can relate to, you know, shooting in the dark sense and then also photo shoot. But I guess that's also kind of just a tool that a writer can do when they're retelling something that really, it doesn't really matter whether the mother-in-law said that or not. All we know that is it's in italics, and for all we know, you know, Tiana could be telling it from verbatim, or she could be retelling in her own version.
I think that she actually might be retelling. And going back to what you said, Sam, about the dark humor that she uses throughout her piece, I think it was really interesting because when I read the word "shoot," I didn't think anything of it.
There's a line here, it's practically in my backyard. I didn't particularly have anything to say on that, but it did strike me, the fact that it was in her backyard. I wanted to know if the two of you might have something to say about that.
Later in the line, it says, "and that her boys played on buckled fields of green graves growing up." And that is not a luxury that, you know, any African-American young boy would ever get during those times, of course, because they'd be on the fields but not playing at all. They would be helping on the fields. And I think that definitely juxtaposes, you know, a white person's experience to a black person's experience, and how she's so, you know, nonchalant in saying that, like, oh, it's practically in my backyard, like my boys were playing on fields and everything. And she doesn't realize that, you know, it's just completely opposite of what any other person with a different background would have. They would just have an entirely different experience. And like, here at this point, it's worth noting that Tiana Clark is biracial, right?
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really significant. And not only that, but she married into a white family, which is really, you know, the subject of this piece, and the ignorance associated with that and the different interpretations on very, very powerful and sad historic events. How can you be on such opposite sides here? You know, taking a photo shoot on, you know, a side of tragedy. I wanted to move to talk a little bit about the reference of the Big Magnolia. I think that it is important to note that this piece, Soil Horizon, is from a collection of Tiana's called I Can't Talk About the Trees Without the Blood. And through that collection, through the whole thing, you hear references of trees, roots, leaves. And one thing that you know was conspicuous about this detail, the Big Magnolia, is the history in Black literary activism of talking about trees. You think about Nina Simone's Strange Fruit and how powerful that song was, and really it was a huge controversy because it was very graphic, as it should have been. It really, really attacked just the graphic nature of racism, especially at the time Nina Simone lived and before then. You know, Tiana has a very strong connection with Nina Simone as a Black activist. And, you know, Tiana's connection, I think, is relevant here. It is relevant to mention that. And even more so, I think, in terms of modern song, we think about Kanye West's piece, Blood on the Leaves, which did, in fact, use lines and parts of Nina Simone's Strange Fruit. So we see this evolution and the fight for racial equality and the presence of Black activism. We find this constant reference of trees. And I think that's especially powerful for that reason.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because for me, what I noticed really about that whole stanza is that it was just really white American dream. You know, rocking chairs. There, at the very end, it says rocking chairs tipping back and forth. And that screamed like elderly white men and women to me.
To work off of what V just mentioned, one profound part of this piece, I think, is the reference of mint juleps, which I really wanted to talk about. I think, you know, as someone from Kentucky, I think of the Derby. It is the white beverage of Derby. There is also what to me has been subtle, but maybe not to a minority race, the Stephen Foster's My Old Kentucky Home. That piece was written from the perspective of a slave. A lot of people don't realize that there were significant chunks of that piece that were omitted, and now it is a severely abbreviated version. So I think it is important to recognize that reference to mint juleps might be more than a beverage in this context, but rather a symbol of tradition that carries that racial ignorance with it, and the racial ignorance of her mother-in-law. So I wanted to consider that and get your all's thoughts on that as well.
In that section of the piece, I sort of was drawn to summer weddings more than mint juleps, because summer weddings just scream a ground that has a lot of history, and it has a lot of past to it, and a lot of that past is really, really like horrible and violent.
Yeah, it reminded me of the song Rock in the Suburbs by Ben Folds, where a line actually says that the suburbs, you know, are built on Indian burial grounds. You know, and I think that's, you know, in direct relation to what this poem is talking about, a plantation, which obviously has so much history, but is now used for weekend reenactments and summer weddings, and is such a green and happy place. But then, of course, it's also talking about the purple stains of Confederate blood.
Yeah, and I actually have never listened to that song, so that's really interesting. But going off of what you said about the purple stains of Confederate blood, when I read that, I thought it could mean no one had bothered to clean it.
That's right. Yeah, there might be some apathy there. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because I didn't really interpret it that way. I think when I heard the purple stains, I thought maybe it was just playing with that process of forgetting. It's almost like the tarnishing of metal or the rust of metal. It's this idea of forgetting, in a sense that what was once a vibrant red and perhaps poignant is now, it's like, to many white people, especially in the South, racism doesn't really exist. But we see that racism is now present in other ways. It hasn't gone away. It's rather evolved into what we see now in institutionalized discrimination and police brutality. Especially this year, we've seen just that coming to life for a lot of people who didn't originally recognize how prominent it was and how much of an issue it was. I think that one thing we can say about it is that Tiana's doing multiple things with just this pointing out that the fact that the blood is purple. It's like, was it really about that they didn't clean it up? It might also be about, I think it could be about both things, where it's also about the idea of forgetting.
I think it is a little bit of both, actually.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting that it's not just a purple stain of Confederate blood, it's purpled stains of Confederate blood, as in she's, you know, directly insinuating that it's happened over time and it's purpled, as in, you know, verb form.
Yeah, using the adjective purple as a verb in that verb form, playing with part of speech like that. Tiana, to me, is a poet who defies rules of grammar and sentence structure and punctuation and formatting in all the right ways. It's really modern, it's really different and original, what she's able to do. I also wanted to, you know, kind of going back to the discussion of suburbia, I wanted to mention the idea of when Tiana says, she kept saying redeem, as if to say, we'll make it acceptable, restore and atone, buy it back, pay it off, we'll redeem it, she said again. So there is a consumerism here. There is a materialism that I think is, you know, especially present in white culture, which in the U.S. has historically gathered up the money. The economic fruit has really gone to the white race in the U.S. The you know, the pay it off idea. Maybe the money there is really intentional, and that pay it off, buying it back, just shows how arrogant the mother is about this whole thing. How the whole idea of, can't we just let this slide? Can't we just forget it and ignore the painful symbolism, the painful associations Tiana has with this place? And can't we just reimburse you in this heartbreaking and insensitive way? Can we reimburse you with this artificial forgiveness and not really knowing what they're sorry for? I don't think that the mother recognizes at all what she's sorry for, and kind of started this phone conversation to Tiana, like as if she was actually asking permission to have the photo shoot on the plantation. She was just trying to guilt Tiana into saying that she would forgive her and corner her.
You know, Sam, you brought up capitalism. When I saw it, I really just thought of, I associated directly with when people would buy slaves and buy people and treat them as property.
I actually kind of want to go back to the first page, sort of after where it said purple stains of Confederate blood. It says, and she laughed and I laughed, which is to say I wasn't joking at all.
There might be more context to be given here. I think if you think of Maya Angelou's poem, The Mask, you know, very famous poem, and a devastating live performance, where you can see how emotional it was for Angelou to perform that. That poem, a theme throughout that poem is the idea of laughter as a, you know, this way of responding to discrimination in order to keep a job in a system that is so controlled by white people. And it's interesting, I think, that that might also be easily drawn from this, which is to say I wasn't joking at all. You know, how historic is that fake and uncomfortable laughter here in response to discrimination?
And I actually just thought that, you know, she was laughing at her ignorance. She was laughing directly at the mother-in-law, but the mother-in-law took it as, oh, she's just laughing at, you know, the joke.
I wonder if Tiana really even wants us to have a finite answer. I think what's awesome about this poem is the uncertainty that it leaves you with. It's almost, you know, is getting readers to feel discomfort other than just the content itself. It's in the delivery. It's in really the formatting, the way it kind of jumps around, the M dashes are used, the where the emphasis is placed. This is uncomfortable even in the flow, the syntax, and obviously in this awful content itself. In this horrifying historic time. So I do think that the delivery and content are parallel in a way that makes the piece even more moving for the reader.
Yeah, and the M dash, she uses it a solid three times in three stanzas, and it's all to relate certain thoughts to another thought. And it's kind of that sort of writing style is present in when, you know, you're just getting angry about something, or you're spiraling down, you know, a certain
thing. And you can see how, you know, the words that her mother-in-law said provoked her to do this kind of thing or undergo this kind of distress, like Sam was saying.
One of the things in this piece that stuck out to me is the sweating in silver cups. Sweating silver cups is mentioned. And I'll read that portion. It says, "And now it's sold out for summer, weddings with mint juleps and sweating silver cups." So sweating to me is not only the condensation of the cup, but perhaps perspiration as well. The blacks at that time in the field, you know, renewing the crops, facilitating that cycle, allowed for white luxury. The use of sweating there, rather than just a direct reference to condensation, I think does have a sort of double meaning about it. It is pretty flexible in your interpretation. And when we think about the perspiration and the black labor, Tiana is deeply connected to that, obviously. It's so relevant in this modern age as we see racism morph into something else, pretty much arguably by the decade sometimes. It seems like we see it take on this new form. You can really see, I think, one powerful portion of this poem is when it says, "How do we stand on the dead and smile? I carry so many black souls in my skin, sometimes I swear it vibrates like a tuning fork when struck." Now, a tuning fork, as musicians know, you strike it and it gives you a specific note, and you can use that note that it produces to tune other instruments. So I think this is Tiana saying that those black souls are the tuning fork that she works off of. How does Tiana's everyday interactions, like with her mother-in-law and with her husband's whole family, how was that affected by those vibrating black souls? How is she tuned to them? That's really very interesting and extremely moving, I think, that she chose that specific simile.
And it literally shows that we can't let the past be the past. Of course not, because everything has to be in historical context. And this tuning fork, the black souls, being her tuning fork, really demonstrates that. Another point in the poem that I thought was worth mentioning is when it says, "Weathering its way down to the bright green topsoil, fertile with the past." So how is that significant for you guys, fertile with the past?
Well, you get the, you know, the literal fertility of the soil. One thing that you can think about here and that's really disturbing is the way that a body might work towards making the soil more capable of growing things, in this grass that covers up the truth now and causes people to forget perhaps the corpses and those black souls that were buried there. I mean, again, we talk about how white specialization and unreasonable leisure and the flow of life was possible because of those black souls that are physically bringing fertility to that soil. And Mayuka, I wanted to pass something to you. What do you think about the hair curling that's going on here?
Right. So people of color, and especially black people, have a certain hair texture that sometimes, in order to comply to certain, you know, workplace mandates, which is a really horrible thing to mandate, or really just to comply to Western culture, you have to straighten it. And I think as the light drizzle that she's talking about, turning her pressed hair slowly back to curls, it's kind of demonstrating how she returns to her root. She's returning to her blackness. And that would be as a result of the rain, but, you know, maybe even also as a result of the conversation she had with her mother-in-law.
Yeah, it's really interesting, that whole idea of conformity that's there, and how Tiana is present on this grave site and this site of unimaginable tragedy, you know, that return to her natural self. And she's doing something that's very unnatural for her, obviously, that, you know, every bone in her body is fighting. She's doing it anyway. And as that photo is being taken, her hair is changing back to its original form. That conformity, that this symbolic conformity there is dissipating. It's going away, and I think that the guilt is really taking over. Tiana is starting to really lean more and more throughout this piece into her true identity.
And another thing that's worth mentioning, sort of in the same area of the piece, is I'm staring at the black eye, clutching my smile. And I think that the reference to the black eye could mean a lot of different things. The first meaning it could have is that Tiana, when she was getting her photo taken, she was looking into the camera lens, because the camera lens is black, and that's, you know, the most simple explanation for black eye. Another thing it could be is that she's looking into a black person's eyes, or maybe she was even looking into the eyes of a black person whose life had been lost in the Civil War and had been buried on that ground. It could also mean a black eye from an injury.
Yeah, and to what extent is that black eye, that black perspective, Tiana's? Well, I think the modern perspective is undoubtedly Tiana's. I mean, you can see how relevant this thing is. But I think maybe what Tiana's struggling with here, that she's walking us through as readers, is she's looking into the black eye, maybe the history of the black perspective, and analyzing how much of that perspective she shares in her present-day interactions. This poem, a lot of what's here is this succumbing to the arrogance of whites. And I think that there is a guilt in Tiana's mind. And this, I can imagine, in writing this poem, it's really letting all that guilt out on the page. You know, you keep hoping throughout this poem that Tiana's going to say, no, it's not okay. But why would Tiana frame herself in this way as someone who kind of gave in to her mother's request? I mean, I imagine it would be a pretty awkward thing for her to say, you know, absolutely not. But after reading this poem, you wonder to what extent Tiana wishes that she had refused her mother's proposal to have the photo shoot occur on the plantation. I did want to talk about the whole concept of the soil we see in the third stanza from the bottom. Mayuka, can you speak a little bit to the idea of, and also the fourth stanza from the bottom, the iron and clay and aluminum? Maybe read that for us, those two stanzas, and start us off with it.
Yeah. Light drizzle turning my pressed hair slowly back to curls, the water percolating, weathering its way down to the bright green topsoil, fertile with the past, organic and holy, wet as Dixie myth, mixing with iron, clay, aluminum, and revision, romancing the dirt and the undead, churning the silt into the subsoil, steeping further down, deep, deep into the dark pocket of earth, to the parent material, layers of large unbroken rocks, down to the antebellum base, the bedrock of southern amnesia. Right, so the first thing I noticed was, you know, we don't just have the reference to the Civil War from the word antebellum, but also Dixie myth, because Dixie land, just the word Dixie in general relates to the South, right? And I know that here in Kentucky, we have the Dixie Highway, which definitely is associated with the Civil War because it was a line to draw from the South and the North that Kentucky itself kind of differed between. And also, she talks a lot about the dirt, right? And this is in direct association with the title, Soil Horizon. So a soil horizon is indicative of all the layers in the soil and the sediments. And a horizon is usually when the sky and the land meet. But in this case, this is where all the layers meet. And all the layers that she talks about previously in the poem, you know, her roots. And it also talks about layers of large unbroken rocks down to the antebellum base, the bedrock of southern amnesia. It's really interesting that she says southern amnesia, because amnesia as in, you know, her mother-in-law is kind of forgetting everything that happened on this plantation and the fact that it's pretty much a graveyard. But then also the general southern amnesia, where I think a lot of us as Americans, even to this day, try to distance ourselves from our shared past and our shared history.
Yeah, and you got to wonder how much of that amnesia is subliminal. I mean, in this right. Self-justification, this immense presence of self-justification, it's this whole MLK idea of not seeing race at all. It's interesting that that was kind of the 60s solution. And one thing that Tiana says in a different poem in this collection of poems is you know, when I think of a post-racial America, I don't. And that's really interesting. The idea of, can unseeing race really be the answer, or do we need to start seeing race and like what we see? I think it's just, you know, in these layers that we're exploring, in this soil horizon, we are picking apart all the different opportunities white people have seized in many cases to forget. And now they're mixing together. Now they're bubbling to the surface as this rainwater pours down. And especially for Tiana, who is well aware of the traumatic events that occurred for Black people in times of slavery and those events that continue to occur in different ways, but under the same principles.
It also has a lot to do with culture appropriation and appreciation. Sometimes we do need to see color in order to educate ourselves, but then through that education, it's important, it's really important to not appropriate the culture and more appreciate it. And I just wanted to go back to the weekend reenactment that was on the second page. Cannons burst from weekend reenactments. So weekend reenactments, you know, the Civil War reenactments are sort of like a source of entertainment in some ways. I guess it depends on how you see it, but you can also see it as a glorification of the Civil War. You can see it as an education about the Civil War. People go there to learn more about it. And it's really, really important the way that you approach certain things like this so as to not be appropriating culture and as to not, you know, have a kind of savior complex, and in order to see exactly what happened for what it was.
Yeah, and reading a textbook is different than passing a statue on the street. The textbook just seems to report the facts, ideally from almost like a state of journalism. And I think that a lot of times we're seeing opinion in journalism now, which is, you know, there's a whole debate as to whether that's good or bad or somewhere in between. But I think in a textbook, you know, you get this objective view of history. But obviously there is a glorification that comes with statues. And I think it's especially relevant at this time where we're seeing the prominence of statues being torn down, covered in paint, and specifically Confederate statues. And it's like, you know, that may be long overdue. It's like, are we going to mention them in textbooks? Or are we going to also glorify them? I just can't understand why we would be okay in this day and age with glorifying a Confederate soldier or a slave owner in the way that we do. For me, this following part here I'm about to read is really the harshest and one where you just have to almost stop reading the piece and step away from it. You can't really, considering that this poem is in a collection of poems, you can't really continue to the next poem. After you read this specific piece, it says, "It's raining. The photographer is snapping and directing us toward the daffodils, the shutter opening and closing like a guillotine, clicking." So we get this idea of clicking as perhaps a passage of time. Maybe we hear a clock. But I think there's also the presence of this brutal sound associated with a loss of life that comes with the guillotine. I think the sound of decapitation is relevant here. I think Clark might be talking about just how haunting it was to step into this graveyard where the most inhumane methods of murder were present. And I, you know, it's hard to sit with that and even really continue throughout the remaining five stanzas after reading something like that. And as we kind of start to come to a close here on this analysis of this piece, I think one thing that is important to mention is the distortions of time throughout the poem. So in Tiana's consciousness, in Tiana's perspective of this whole issue, this is so time-oriented. It's digesting history. It's saying, what is relevant to me? What am I going to condone in my own modern actions? Am I going to, you know, conform to this harmful forgetting that her mother-in-law and her husband's whole family seem to stand for? And those distortions, I think, are actually relevant in the poem itself, and in the, not only in the content, but the poem itself has this whole idea of jumping from one tense to another. There are times in this poem where things are communicated in past tense, and then it feels like you're right in the moment. One thing I think we could mention, maybe we should have at the beginning, but it is an epigraph. This poem is based off of a quote. That quote reads, "The ghost of history lies down beside me, rolls over, pins me beneath a heavy arm." And that's by Natasha Trethewey. You can't really fully grasp that quote without the piece, and perhaps you can't grasp the piece without the quote. So you almost return to it at the end, as we have done. And you think about, why is it so often really in Tiana's writing? I think I heard from her one time at the conference. I was there when Tiana was talking. She said, "My professor is always giving me a hard time about writing too many epigraphs, and that not enough of my writing is based on my own ideas." Well, this is, a very original piece of work, and I think it's fair to say that there are instances in which Tiana proves her professor very wrong. I think this is very, very effective in terms of its originality as an epigraph. Can we talk a little bit about the meaning of that quote? And V, I can pass it to you here.
Yeah, so for me, when I first read it, when it says, "rolls over, pins me beneath a heavy arm," I was thinking of, two people, a couple, sleeping in the same bed. And, one of them rolling over and putting their arm around the other in a sort of maybe a safe way or like a comforting way, depending on the situation. And I think that that's interesting because it's almost as if to say that the ghost of history comforts and goes along with and is with the individual.
Right. And that arm, you talked about the bed analogy, which is really interesting. I hadn't thought about that at all. And perhaps, there's a significance that her husband is white here. That's a big piece of it. That whole rolling over, you get the idea of what could be a slumber. But I think when you think about standing on top of a graveyard, it's almost like you have hands at your feet, grabbing your ankles, and she's being pulled down into what picks and pries at her. I think that this, for Tiana, is not just being pulled down, but it's something that she herself is picking her feet up to do. And with that, I want to hear any closing remarks on the piece as a whole, what it did for you all, and then we'll move to the student piece.
First off, I just wanted to say that I really appreciate Tiana's writing this. It's a very heavy topic, and the fact that she approached it at certain points, almost with humor, and other points with pretty much taking a deep dive into the hitting parts of it, was very brave, in my opinion. And it is something that you have to kind of take a step back from and analyze yourself from your perspective. And yeah, so I appreciated the whole poem. So now to a student piece by Sam Baker.
The Yellow. She ran her thumb along the top of the boy's shoulder, like there was something there she couldn't wipe clean. Her grip leaned into Jack's arm, as if reliant on him in some way, though he couldn't imagine she was. They knew each other more through his mother than any of the limited times they'd spoken. Miss Harold was a realtor. A few months prior, she'd become a great friend to Jack's mother, and found her the perfect home in the accessible part of town, where restaurants and shops were near the city enough to adopt the fact of walking distance, but too far from it to draw a bustling rush hour. It was where his mother had wanted to be since she'd settled down with his father on the East End 20 years before. There, estates were nestled into wooded seclusion, where even the frequented errand was 15 minutes away by car. It grew to be unbearable for her. Whether after or before, she could no longer love his father, Jack wasn't sure. Miss Harold's limp fingers became tight around his arm as they watched the snake glide up the wall of her home and arch its neck to make out the remaining distance to the roof. "My gosh," she laughed. "That thing must be at least 4 feet long." "It sure was hard to miss when we were weeding the beds," Jack added, as Tyler approached them through the closing gate in her backyard. "Truck's almost loaded," he mumbled.
Tyler, the snake's up the wall now. I thought the damn thing went back in the ground. He wiped down his sopping forehead with the shriveled end of his sleeve and sent a subtle nod to Miss Harold, as if beginning to apologize to her for his language. Well, we'll have to get rid of it, Miss Harold insisted. What do you think, boys? That might be a little beyond the guys who trim shrubs, Jack cackled uselessly, as he and Tyler set down their final load of equipment to prepare themselves already for the obligation. That past spring, the two boys had started their local landscaping business in an attempt to make more money for school than the $7.25 plus tips high school jobs would allow. Miss Harold found the home for Jack's mother more as a favor than for profit. The sale was much smaller than her regulars. For her generosity, Jack and Tyler offered her their occasional services at a lowered price. She didn't take long to accept, but she never seemed satisfied when they finished a job. At the end of every visit, the boy would call her out to inspect everything. She'd smile and say something along the lines of, "It's better," as she plucked a small weed from the ground that they'd overlooked, or measured two mirroring bushes with one eye open and an outstretched thumb. Yet she'd often send them home with food out of her garage refrigerator that they couldn't decline, or a check written for more than they billed her. She'd started insisting that they call her Miss H. She never could leave the slightest thing out of order, certainly not anything making its way up her brick wall. The boys seemed to share the sudden idea that the snake would be a rare opportunity to escape their debt to her. "Where should we take it?" Jack asked. "Well, I don't imagine you have to take it anywhere. When I was married, my son David used to just chop the head off. You want us to kill it?" "Well, I don't imagine it'll hurt you if you cut it right." "We can't leave it here, boys. That thing is a threat wherever it goes. Look at those yellow marks on its back. We don't know what kind it is. What do you think?" Miss Harold told the boys all about her son, how brave he was to kill the snakes that approached their home before he'd gone away years before. He'd take one mighty hack and watch it squirm in two pieces for 10 minutes and then come to a stop. He'd made a thorough routine of it. "What if I put it in a trash can and wheel it down the street to the woods?" Miss Harold looked at Jack and laughed at the idea, but quickly stopped herself when she saw his eyes fixed on the snake, twitching in unison with even its slightest movements along the wall. "I suppose we could empty one of my cans," she admitted, with a hesitation Jack felt he noticed more than her. She led the boys to her garage, where Jack and Tyler moved the trash out of one garbage can and placed it in another. Jack grabbed a plastic rake for maneuvering the snake, and Tyler wheeled the can. By the time they arrived in the backyard, the snake had migrated from the wall to the ground, or had perhaps fallen suddenly. "It won't be as easy now," Jack announced in what sounded like a confession. "I would have rather been able to knock it off the wall into the can." Tyler volunteered to pick the snake up and dump it into the can. Taking the rake from Jack's hand, he edged closer to the unmoving animal, extending the rake out in front of him with one hand, placed as close to the end of the handle as possible. Tyler leaned forward and touched one of the rake's plastic tines to the snake's body and yanked his hand back as the snake moved its head in a single jerk and held firmly in the position. Its neck was raised and it stared in Tyler's direction, though not really at him. More so at where the rake had been. Tyler walked off to the side of the snake where Jack stood, but the snake kept its eyes staring forward. The rest of its body hadn't moved at all. It could hardly see. It took Miss Harold's arrival in the backyard for the boys to realize she had left again. She walked through the gate with a metal rake in her hand. It didn't work, Tyler told her. "Well, it wasn't that we couldn't move it, we're just afraid it'll bite us if we try." "And why shouldn't you be? It's not worth the risk, boys. What do you think?" "Well, it might still work," Jack urged. "If I lay the trash can on one side, I can nudge the snake into it instead of having to lift it up and over." I'm afraid if we let it live, it'll come back. Not if I wheel it down the street to the woods. But you can't do that. Why not? The neighbors will wonder what you're doing. Well, I can certainly tell them. How about you dump it in my backyard? What do you think? She pointed to the fence on the other side of the yard. Then it'll surely come back. I thought you wanted it gone. I do. Miss Harold walked over to the snake with the metal rake in hand. Don't you have a spade shovel or something? Tyler asked. It's not long enough. I can't get too close to the snake. What do you think? She set the rake down on the patio in front of the snake and walked over it to a rock laying in the nearby mulch bed. Maybe this will do, she said. As she approached the snake once again, Jack noticed it had put its head back down with little worry of what stood around it. Miss H, Jack started. We can tilt the can over and try again. Jack moved the can to its side to show her, but she didn't move her eyes from the snake. Miss H? But she had dropped it. Jack spun around to look away as the impact of the rock rattled the pavement beneath his feet. God, he's quick. He's got to be mad now, Tyler laughed. As Jack turned around to find that the snake had narrowly escaped the rock while it was in midair, Miss Harold picked up the metal rake and sank it into the snake. The snake opened its mouth and thrashed its head about, as if trying to find where the repeated blows were coming from. Jack attempted to talk to Miss Harold as the sound of the ruthless bangs of the metal smacking the pavement filled her ears. Can we shoot it? What if we burn it? Man, I have a terrible aim, she laughed as the snake still struggled slowly beneath her force, her rows of teeth pressed together in satisfaction at the give in the snake's caving body. The snake's mouth opened wider and wider as its eyes bulged from their sockets with each impact and the holes in its body leaked. The raw underskin glistened with the pores of a sponge. Miss Harold added force as she thought of her son. When they'd taken him away from her, the claims her husband made when he came home to find their baby girl collapsed on the floor. She pictured the home she sold to full families by the day, and the fantasy she saw in each one. The buyer's young children running into their empty rooms, gleaming at their potential. It wasn't long before she discovered parents' preferences for a home with model furniture and a child's love for a blank canvas. She'd occasionally sit down on the floor with the children and ask what color they'd paint their walls, and then take them to the fireplace in the home and show them how to talk to someone outside through the chimney chutes. Miss Harold brought the rake above her head now. If she'd found her little girl in that room just minutes earlier, she'd still be in her world smiling on the wall and photographs she never took. Her staring eyes filled with tears as the cap and gown her little girl would have worn that spring stood in her mind next to the faded spot on her couch. She'd meant to call the upholsterer. Her palms shook on the rake now, the uncertain hands that once scrubbed the soap from her daughter's budding hair with the haste to wash it free, but the care for a fragile skull still forming. She could still save her. Jack watched closer now as the blood rolled across the pavement and the dark chunks he saw in his nosebleeds as a young boy. The snake's mouth closed gradually now, just as it had opened. The swings continued, raking concrete flakes off the patio floor, as Miss Harold murmured, "I know. God bless you. God bless you." Jack listened to her repeating the phrase that ran through her lips like a song. The snake thrashed less and less in the clutches of her rake, tangled around the metal teeth like a shoelace. She sat the rake down and dropped the rock on the contorted body. This time it could not get away. God bless you. God bless you. The snake lied beneath the rock with its eyes closed and its mouth shut. Miss Harold went to pick up the rake for more, but the boys moved in on her. I have to make sure, she cried. It's gone, Tyler told her. Jack grew nauseated as she dropped the rake and knelt down by the snake to take pictures of the punctured body lying limp. "My David should see," she said. When she finished, Tyler picked up the dangling body with the rake and dropped it in the can. "Don't worry about the blood," she smiled, her eyes relieved and drier than before. "I'll just spray it off with the hose. You boys have done enough already today." She went inside to get the check Jack had forgotten about entirely. Their 6 hours of work on the day felt to Jack as if it had happened weeks before. All he could think about was heading home to his mother, where he knew she waited for him. His dinner would be cold by then, but good as always. She would ask him how the job went, and hint at the question of how much he made. If it wasn't too personal, she'd say. It never was. Miss Harold returned promptly with the check in hand, made out for just the right amount. She must have calculated it in her head when Jack forgot to mention her total. She handed the boys each a cash tip as usual and told them the weeds would be back soon. Jack attempted to refuse the tip, and then Tyler, but they knew she'd insist, pocketing their earnings the moment she began to respond. Jack would not fall asleep until the early hours of the next morning. The ringing that filled the quiet walls of his room would occupy him as he reached for a pillow as a poor alternative to something cold against his cheek. The light posts would litter his sleep through the window as he dreamt of it all, the blood washing from the hard floor, just as she had done, with a hose as the truck rolled away, the blood pouring into the grass and down the roots to the soil where the small bones slept. And hanging on her garage wall was the dirty shovel she watched swinging faintly each day as she waited for the stillness.
That was The Yellow by Sam Baker. Baker's works have appeared most notably in The Evocations Review, Up North Lit, The Ice Colony, The Elevation Review, Straightforward Poetry, and The Kin Literary Journal. The first thing that I wanted to talk about was actually in the beginning of the piece when it says, "She ran her thumb along the top of the boy's shoulder like there was something there she couldn't wipe clean." And we actually see this a lot throughout the piece where Miss Harold has to have things a certain way. Mayuka, any thoughts on that?
Right, and I think it's interesting how that is kind of juxtaposed later when she just does something that you kind of feel is out of nature for her.
Definitely.
And then also it says her grip leaned into Jack's arm as if reliant on him in some way, though he couldn't imagine she was. So I feel like that's almost like she's treating him like someone who is close to her, like maybe her son. She kind of shows like motherly notions in the beginning of the piece, which later on are a little bit dismissed, in my opinion.
Yeah, her attitude towards the boys can definitely be seen in two different ways. There's sort of the motherly point of view where she's feeling like Jack and Tyler are sort of her kids more than anything. And then there's another point of view where you can think of it like she's trying to make Jack and Tyler sort of be in debt to her or feel as though they're in debt to her for a long, long time.
Right. I mean, there is a part later in the piece that specifically refers to the debt to her, right? It says the boys seem to share the sudden idea that the snake would be a rare opportunity to escape their debt to her. And I thought that was like a interesting way of wording it, escaping the debt, not really paying it off or anything. So like almost like they're under her control somehow, or she's like possessive in some way.
Yeah. And Jack and Tyler's feelings towards Miss Harold are sort of very clear throughout the piece, but it's Miss Harold's intentions that I'm definitely a little confused about.
Also, you can see other motherly behaviors from her when it says, "Yet she'd often send them home with food out of her garage refrigerator that they couldn't decline, or a check written for them more than they billed her. She started insisting that they call her Mrs. H."
Yeah, that's definitely like very motherly of her.
And so the boys, you can kind of see they're also a little bit leaning into that motherly nature when it says, "I thought the damn thing went into the ground. He wiped his sopping forehead with the shriveled end of his sleeve and sent a subtle nod to Miss Harold as if beginning to apologize to her for his language. Normally you do that to, you know, elderly women or, you know, women that you respect.
Yeah, and I actually wanted to sort of shift gears a little bit and talk more about Miss Harold's relationship to the snake and what that could signify. I think that her attitude towards the snake changes a lot throughout the piece, where she initially wants it gone and she wants to kill the snake, and then she, you know, has moments of hesitation where she thinks, oh, we don't need to kill it, we can maybe just let it go in the woods or in the backyard, and then she's definitely more determined much later in the piece to have it gone forever.
Right, yeah, for sure, I definitely agree. She's kind of fluctuating a little bit in her attitude towards the snake. I think it reaches like its climax though when she starts thinking of the personal things, right, like her daughter and her husband and her son.
She also establishes a relationship between the snake and her son David a little bit later in the piece. It sort of makes me think that there hasn't been a lot of snakes around Miss Harold, so I'm wondering why she's remembering her son cutting off the heads of so many snakes.
And immediately after, Jack and Tyler say, "You want us to kill it?" So it's kind of like a little bit of surprise from them, right? It's like the first, like, oh, whoa, what? She wants us to kill the snake. That's really weird. I wouldn't expect, like, you know, someone like her to say something like that. So they were kind of shocked by that as well.
Yeah, and that hesitation throughout the piece leads me to believe that she's not entirely there, as though she's had a sort of trauma, and that's definitely supported later in the piece when she talks about her daughter and her husband coming home to see a bunch of blood.
In the line, "I suppose we could empty one of my cans," she admitted with a hesitation Jack felt he noticed more than her. I think that's kind of building to that climactic moment, because it's kind of like, oh, she's a little bit outside of her body, and Jack noticed her behavior before she did, that hesitation. And I think you'll see a bit more of that later in the piece as well, where she's not totally self-aware of what her behavior is like. Yeah, and speaking of the daughter, I think that whole scene is a little bit confusing, just because you don't know exactly what happened to the daughter, but there are a lot of, you know, theories we could have. So it says, "Miss Harold added for us, as she thought of her son when they'd taken him away from her, the claims her husband made when he came home to find their baby girl collapsed on the floor." So there's a lot of ambiguity on that line. You don't really know if, like, the claims are accusations towards Miss Harold or whether she was even in the room, because later you see that the writer says, "If she'd found her little girl in that room just minutes earlier, she'd still be in the world smiling on the wall in photographs she never took." Right, so she wasn't in the room, but maybe if she came sooner, what exactly was the cause of death? Was it natural? We really have no idea here.
Yeah, and in this line, there's also a part where she talks about her son, David, and it says when they'd taken him away from her. So I think my understanding at this point of what happened is that the daughter had actually passed away in an accident, and Miss Harold had rushed into the room a little bit too late, and her husband was making a lot of accusations at Miss Harold and was saying that, you know, you killed her, or this was your fault, or something like that. And because of that, the husband took David away.
Oh, yeah, that could make sense. But then also, I feel like the son would be a little older, right? Because the son is, you know, killing snakes here and there. So if Mr. Harold was to take him away, wouldn't he have to be, like, younger? I really like the line, "She'd meant to call the upholsterer." So it comes where it says, "Her staring eyes filled with tears as the cap and gown her little girl would have worn that spring stood in her mind next to the faded spot on her couch. She meant to call the upholsterer." Yeah, so I really like that line because an upholsterer is someone that provides furniture with a soft padded covering, and that's usually, you know, to cover up that faded spot on her couch. I think that was a really clever line. I'm a little bit confused by the line, "She could still save her," because it comes after Her palms shook on the rake now, the uncertain hands that once scrubbed the soap from her daughter's budding hair with the haste to wash a tree with the care for a fragile skull still forming. She could still save her. I don't know if she's referring to, like, in the past or right now she's kind of, you know, disillusioned and saying, oh, with the rake or something, she's, like, in that moment.
Well, I'm also a little confused by it, but the way that I read it, Miss Harold was maybe hallucinating a little bit. And so she was thinking that she, by killing the snake, she could still save her daughter. Or maybe it's Miss Harold trying to avenge her daughter, where maybe the daughter had passed away in an incident that involved a snake. And so by killing the snake, Miss Harold is in turn almost avenging her daughter.
Yeah, seriously, maybe. I mean, it's dark, but it's definitely a possibility, especially with the claims that her husband made.
So I actually kind of want to talk about a line that's a couple lines later where Miss Harold is still hitting the snake with the rake, and she's saying, I know, God bless you, God bless you. And she's sort of murmuring that, but Jack could hear her. And she says that, and it says that Jack listened to her repeating the phrase that ran through her lips like a song. And this sort of led me to believe that maybe God bless you was something that Miss Harold had said a lot to her daughter or to her children. And she was now repeating it to the snake and sort of envisioning the snake's dying body as Miss Harold's daughter's dying body.
And you can also see how this kind of affects the boys. Jack watched closer now as the blood rolled across the pavement in dark chunks he saw in his nosebleeds as a young boy. So this is a very dark picture that he's looking at, and it's definitely going to traumatize him. And we're definitely going to see signs of trauma later in the piece as well. And then again, signs of trauma here when it says, it's gone, Tyler told her. Jack grew nauseated as she dropped the rake and knelt down by the snake to take pictures of the punctured body lying limp.
She actually took the pictures to show her son, David, which is strange because earlier in the piece, she did say that her son had been taken away.
Yeah, for sure. And then also, you know, the fact that she smiled, like, I think that line right there, don't worry about the blood, she smiled. That, I think, there really struck me because that's not something you'd ever see combined together, smiling and blood.
Yeah, and the fact that she could recover from, you know, a full breakdown, because earlier she was just hitting the snake over and over again, even after it had died and even after the boys were telling her that, you know, the snake is gone and she doesn't have to worry anymore. She still kept hitting it and she was crying. But here, just, I think probably a few minutes later, she's fine.
Maybe she needed that whole episode to almost express her repressed feelings or something, because her eyes were relieved. And it says, Miss Harold returned promptly with the check in hand, made out for just the right amount. She must have calculated in her head when Jack forgot to mention her total. So obviously the boys are in no state of mind to think about money or what Miss Harold owes them in money. But Miss Harold, after going through the whole episode, she still had the energy or the stability even to calculate it.
The line above the last line, it talks about how Jack is very traumatized about those events and how he's thinking about it as he falls asleep. And one of the things that he's thinking about is the blood pouring into the grass and down the roots to the soil where the small bones slept. The small bones can be attributed to the daughter. The daughter being buried in the ground beneath Miss Harold's house could definitely be a possibility.
And the ultimate line, and hanging on her garage wall was the dirty shovel she watched, swinging faintly each day as she waited for the stillness. That's a really great ending line, first of all. Just waiting for the stillness is really impactful. So stillness on the wall, like with the shovel, and then also stillness in her world, kind of. At least that's how I interpreted it. Like, Miss Harold is still suffering from all of that past trauma, and she's kind of waiting for the stillness and stability in her own mind to recover from all of it.
And they hadn't used the shovel that day, so I'm, you know, a little wary of the word dirty. Like, why was the shovel dirty if they hadn't used it?
Right, and she was overtly hesitant to have the boys use the shovel because she said it wasn't long enough, so they used a rake instead.
We've analyzed the entire piece, and I sort of want to talk about the different possibilities for what had happened here, because it's not especially clear to the reader. So the possibility that I think is most likely is Miss Harold had left her alone, and she came into the room where her daughter was, you know, suffering or dying a little bit too late, and so the daughter had passed away. And that's when the husband came home and began accusing her of things like, you killed our daughter, or you are the reason that this happened. And they came to a sort of agreement to not call the police or not involve the authorities with this, and they buried the daughter on their property.
Yeah, I also agree that I think is the most likely possibility. So another possibility, which I personally think is a little less likely, is Miss Harold killing her daughter. Not completely out of question, though, because, again, there are the claims that the husband made when he found their daughter lying on the floor, collapsed. And so maybe even Miss Harold returned to the room out of guilt after maybe it wasn't even an accident. She ended up killing her, but it was an accident.
Yeah, and that guilt would surely explain a lot of the stuff that Miss Harold had exhibited in this piece, where with the snake, where she was, you know, hesitant to kill it, and then she killed it very violently, and then she was, you know, tied to it as it was dying.
Right, and throughout the piece, you can see that there's not a lot of affection towards her husband from Miss Harold. It's a very almost loveless kind of way that she describes him. He only appears once, you know, so maybe there's kind of an anger towards him as well. She's definitely not as loving towards him as she is towards her son and her daughter.
Yeah, and that would support the idea that the husband had actually taken away David because of the incident. And because of that, Miss Harold sort of resents Mr. H.
So overall, I really like this piece. First of all, it was very well written. Each character was developed very well, and everything kind of circled back to the beginning. And there was a lot of fluctuation, but it kind of balanced out, I think, for each character, the boys and Miss Harold. And also, I kind of like just the mystery of it all. Of course, that definitely is a writer's tool. I don't think the writer would want us to have a singular conclusion to this. And I think the darkness of it all, the thrilling kind of suspense of it all, works. I think the writer definitely did a good job of building that suspense and definitely writing that climax moment. I think that was really impactful.
Yeah, definitely. And I absolutely love the mystery aspect of it.
And with that, we are going to conclude the first episode of The Icebox. Thank you so much for listening, everyone, and we will see you in the next episode.
The music you hear was written by Manuel's very own Youth Performing Arts School percussionist Aaron Muller. To find more of Aaron's works, check out the description for this episode. The Icebox website invites listeners to submit pieces of their own for discussion on the podcast or publish pieces they'd like to hear analyzed. Thank you for joining us on The Icebox. For now, I'm Sam Baker. Keep the pen warm, and we'll see you next time.